program on what it was like, what happened, and what it is like now. If the speaker wishes to stop early before 6:20, he may do so, and we will open the meeting for questions. As a reminder, please be aware that if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the Light a Candle podcast. Welcome to the OA Light a Candle meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find several speaker feeds with over 800 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Alex F.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Alex. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Alex.
Thank you to Lisanne for asking me to be of service. I really, really, really have to be of service because I am so selfish. I'm so self-centered. I don't care about anything but what I want to do. And that's the way my brain is wired. And so I have to be pushed in some way or another to do this contrary action, to be here, to try to share my experience, to try to be of use to somebody, some way. And so I'm really grateful for that. Happy birthday, Lucy. Welcome, Sasha. And I forgot your name.
Mallory.
There's a lot. If you're new, you know, I've got 6 years of abstinence, and Lucy was celebrating 16. There may be people who have a lot more or a lot less. But just if you're a newcomer, just remember that no matter how much time somebody has here, they had to get one day first, you know? And so all the time that I have is kind of like gone already, you know? I have to show up every day anew because my disease and my brain is not wired for gratitude. I'm not set up for recovered thinking. You know, I'm set up for addict thinking. But when I do something like this, when I show up to try to be of service, then I'm practicing my recovery. There's a reason why we use that practice. Because for when it comes to me, you know, I'm either practicing my recovery or I'm practicing my addiction. And I want to practice my recovery. It's a real honor to lead, do the lead share at Light a Candle. I've been around long enough to think about how much this meeting in particular has helped people. And I got here early. I was sitting in my car, and I was feeling okay. And I called my sponsor, and I said, you know, I'm getting ready to lead Light a Candle, and I'm not nervous about it, but now I'm getting nervous that I'm not nervous about it. Yeah. And he said, man, you always need something to worry about. And that's really true. I need to worry about things. I need to be, I'm anxious. I'm scared. I'm not enough. Alex standing here in front of you right now is not enough in my head. I have to be something else. I put on this shirt this morning, 6:30 in the morning. I'm like, what are the people in Light a Candle going to think of this shirt when I put it on, you know? I fantasize. One of my character defects is I fantasize about, like, being somebody more interesting. I fantasize about sharing about more interesting things in meetings. Like, you know, I just got out of prison, and, you know, or whatever it is. It's a continuous thing, and no matter how much work I do in practice, in recovery, it keeps coming up. And it keeps coming to this very same thing, which is that I don't think that I'm enough. And that goes back way to childhood. I grew up in a home that was very loving. But it was unpredictable. It had a lot of, it was loud and a lot going on. And I was a scared kid. I'm still a scared kid. But I was a really particularly scared kid at the time. And all of this unpredictability sort of made me take on these qualities. When I walk in the room, I immediately take the temperature of everybody in this room to make sure that I'm not running afoul of anyone and Maybe I can adjust myself in such a way that will make you like me and make you accept me. I went to the OA birthday party a few years ago. And if you haven't been to the OA birthday party, you really owe yourself a chance to go there. It can be really transformative. And I heard a lady at the meeting share that she didn't like to refer to these things as character defects. She said she called them survival traits. And I really relate to that, because at the time, these are things that I needed to survive my situation. You know, just like at the time, the food. When I was a kid, I was scared. I wasn't enough. I wasn't good enough at sports. I was overweight, and my nickname growing up was Fat Boy. So, you know, try that one on for size and see what that does to your makeup, psychological makeup. And so I needed to be comforted. So I would turn, in my case, I would turn to sugar, flour, or more specifically, the combination of sugar and flour. That's the thing that would send me into, that's how, like what Bill talks about. That's when I would get into that, then I am eating the way the guys in this book drink. You know, the people in this book drink. Searching for oblivion, trying to get to this place where I'm just blacked out. I'm not afraid. I'm not sad. I'm not worried. And I guess at the time it was a useful tool, maybe, you know. I made it to here, so maybe it helped me in some way. But eventually it just... it became a real issue. It was like a bomb, B-A-L-M, and then it became a bomb, like B-O-M-B. It just blew up my life, you know, and in an embarrassing way, because I grew up in a very my particular culture, and the where I grew up was extremely patriarchal, macho culture, and a family and a home. My father was very much classic example of like machismo, you know, and I'd never thought that I was that. Another way in which I just thought I was, you know, not enough. And so it's too embarrassing to me, the way I grew up, to admit that I have some kind of problem with food, you know. You know what it is? I feel like as a man, it's not, in my head, the story that I have is, as a man, I'm not supposed to care what my body looks like. I'm not supposed to be, you know, worry about my waist and you know, all of that. I wake up in the morning, and still to this day, no matter how much time I have in here, you know, the first thing I do is, like, my hands just start pulling my flesh, you know? Like, what, am I going to remove it or something? I'm not sure what I'm doing there, but... So it added this level of, like, I have this shame of I just don't like myself, and I can't tell anybody because it's too shameful for me as a Latino man to say I don't like my body, you know. I've never liked my body. I've pretty much come to the acceptance that I'm never gonna like my body, and maybe that's okay. Maybe by 56, I start to be okay with the idea that I'm fine, you know. But it was really a major struggle, and I needed to comfort myself with the food. And this happened my entire life for almost 5 decades. The way my disease manifested itself is that I would put on and then take off the same 40 pounds or so over and over and over and over again, desperately trying to get down to something that I thought was a weight that I was supposed to be at. And then once I got there, almost immediately, it like shoots around because the pressure or the anxiety, whatever it is, led me to it. And so when I came to Overeaters Anonymous about 7 years ago, I was 49, and I came because I figured I knew I had a problem with food. But it wasn't until I walked into the room. What I learned from all of you was that food was not my problem. Like, if food was my problem, If like sugar and flour was my problem, then abstinence from sugar and flour would solve my problem. But I am abstinent from sugar and flour, and I can tell you, man, my problem is not solved, you know? My problem is that I have a spiritual hole inside of me. And I've spent my whole life trying to fill this hole with food and applause. And it doesn't work for me. It's not worked for me. It's never enough. There's never enough food and there's never enough applause. And again, I just keep going back to this idea of not being enough. So all a lifetime of like trying all sorts of diets, eating in a dark and shameful, disturbing way, not, you know, nobody ever saw my really serious eating. That was really done under, in my car, under the cover of night. I stole food. I stole a box of donuts from little children once. Wrapped and hiding wrappers, going to dinner and then like can't wait to leave this dinner so I can get the real fucking real business of eating underway, you know. Talking again about the OA birthday party, by the way, to talk about how I am still powerless over food, there was a workshop about night eating, like how to deal with night eating, you know? And as I was at the workshop, it was very good, panel discussion. It suddenly occurred, I didn't realize I was doing this until that meeting, was that I delay dinner as late as possible. Like, if I can have dinner at midnight, that would be ideal. I can have dinner, and then I can go to sleep very soon after that, and then I am not going to be in danger of what's going to happen to me overnight, you know? But that's another version of me trying to control things. And whenever I'm trying to control things, that's a real indication to me of a lack of faith, you know? And faith is something that I really want to talk about a lot, because when I came to the program, I was in the program for about a year and a half before I got a sponsor, before I really started working it. I came, but at the time when I showed up, I was I identified myself as a committed atheist, meaning that I didn't just not believe in God, I identified myself that way. I took joy in identifying myself that way and ridiculing people who would live a life of faith and you know, and now I wear a bracelet that says "Let go and let God." So that's hilarious turnout in my life. So I didn't, you know. So when I got the program and they're talking all this God stuff, and I figured, you know, I'm just going to sit in the back. I'm going to get the secret that somebody must have. Somebody's going to have a secret here, and I'll learn it, and I'll lose the weight, and I'll get out, and then I won't have to see any of you ever again, and I'll just sit back there and I'll get it done. And I did this for like a year or more. I took on some nonsense abstinence that I adopted without sponsor direction. You know, I was doing what they say, OA my way. And I at that time I just said, my problem's just bread. I only have a problem with bread, you know. That's all. So if I don't eat bread, I'm all good, you know. Meanwhile, like my lunch would be 3 Snickers bars, and I called that an abstinent lunch, you know. And I'm going to these meetings, and I'm sharing, you know, I can talk a good game, and I can make it seem like I've got recovery, and I can be really generous with people and listen and help set up chairs and all of that. But I was just going to meetings. That's all I was doing. One day, a very close friend of mine and a really maybe my closest creative collaborator went to sleep one night and didn't wake up, and it really rocked me, and this so-called abstinence that I had just snapped like a twig, and I just went racing to the food. I mean, I had been in program enough to know that there was no denying what I was doing. Now I was using food. This was not, I can't say that this is a meal. I can't lie to myself about any of this. I am using food to stop these feelings that I am having, that I don't want to have. And the only thing I did right in all of that, because I just went hog wild, was I went back to the meeting and I shared about it. I shared what was going on. And after the meeting, somebody came up to me, an angel that I'm so grateful for. She said, if you want to feel better, go to a meeting. If you want to get better, work the steps. And I'm so grateful that I heard that I was able to hear it enough that I could continue. Because I had so many examples in my lifetime of, like, you know, losing a bunch of weight and then suddenly the weight comes back on. And I think, why am I not able to control this? I'm able to master so many things in my life. Why is this thing completely beating me, you know? I didn't have this connection that I have learned since I've been here, which is that it has to do with my inability or I don't know how to have feelings. I don't know how to have them. And when I have them, I don't want to have them. I want to feel good or I want to feel nothing. That's what I want to have. And so when I have complicated feelings, my entire life, I have dealt with those feelings with food. So it feels utterly natural for me to deal with, to do it that way. So this person told me to go the steps is when I went to another meeting. There had been a guy that I met at another meeting called Serenity Sunday. He had introduced himself to me when I was a newcomer. And he never sort of left my mind. I thought this guy has what I want. He seems to have a kind of peace. He seems to have a neutrality about things. He seems to be he always talked about the thing that that impacted him so much in program was page 417 of this book, having to do with the chapter on acceptance. And so I went to the meeting. I said, I'm going to go to this meeting, and if he's there, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. Because for me, they say in program, you know, the hardest thing to do in program is to walk into the room the first time, and I believe that's probably true. But for me, a very close second was asking somebody to sponsor me. Like, the thought of me, you know, going up, a grown-ass man walking up to another grown-ass man and saying, like, apple fritters have kicked my ass, please help me. And I showed up at this meeting, and not only was he there, he was leading the meeting. And I started working with him. And that day is when my recovery actually began. A year and a half after coming to OA and working, you know, showing up to meetings, that's the day the recovery actually began. And the reason it actually began that day was because that was my first real surrender. Surrendering my story. Surrendering what I think I know. Surrendering control. Or rather, I was in program for years before this finally dawned on me. I keep talking about, like, wanting to just give up control. I've got to find a way to find the courage to give up control. And it occurred to me just not that long ago that I'm not giving up control. I'm giving up the illusion of control. I don't have any control at all. At all. In no way do I can't control, you know, that my friend died. I can't control outcomes of things that matter to me. I can't control the climate. I can't control anything. And any time that I think I can, when I walk into a room and I think I'm going to be charming and I'm going to make these people like me, that's once again me thinking that I have any control. If I think that, okay, I'm gonna have some pizza and this time I'm going to moderate it, you know, it's an illusion. But that illusion is really hard to give up, at least for me. I heard somebody say that the world is like a log floating on a river, and we're all just 7 billion ants on this log, and every one of us thinks we're steering. Uh-huh. You know, we are not. I've spent a lot of time just trying to muscle my way through life, thinking that, in fact, a lot of my self-worth I tied into like my ability to try to get you to do something that I want you to do. to try to control you. And Paige, I forget what Paige, you know, talks about, you know, being the actor. I want to control the ballet and the lighting and the, and that's absolutely me. I want to control everything. I want to control all of you. And the reason I want to control you is because I am terrified of you. I'm terrified that you're going to see what I see when I look in the mirror, which is that I'm not enough, that I'm worthless, that I am not worthy of the love of a higher power or anything. I start working with this guy, and I tell him right away, I'm an atheist, man. I'm like a hardcore atheist. I don't know how I'm going to do this, get to step three and work on this, turning my will over. And he says, slow down. You haven't even done step one yet. But let's just start, you know. And we started. He was so gentle with me and so patient. And I started working. I did, you know, he had me write a want ad. I'm sure many of you have done this. You read a want ad of, like, the kind of higher power you would like. And but it was really difficult as we kept going. Once we got to a certain point where I just, like, really hit the brakes and I can't deal with this. And he wasn't, like, judging me, nothing like that. He just let me just, you know, take my time. And I went back to this other meeting that I go to, and I talked to another guy in that meeting who I really was connected to, who also came to this program as an atheist. He told me once, I was an atheist before this program, I was an atheist after, and my higher power is an atheist. And I said to him, you know, I just don't know if I can accept that there's a power greater than myself. And he said, well, can you accept gravity? Do you accept that gravity is a power greater than you? And I tell this story a lot, and every time I tell it, it seems so stupid, but it really was huge in my life, because what all that did was it opened up the door of willingness just that much, so that I could say, yeah, of course, I can't control gravity. If I step off a building, I'm going to die, because gravity is going to pull me very quickly to the earth. I can't control the tide. The tide is coming in, and I can't do anything about it. I can't control the change in temperature. I can't control. What else can I not control in my life? I can't control what other people think of me. I can't control the outcomes of anything, you know. And that was the beginning of it. That was the beginning of my work to try to get rid of this other story that was not serving me. This story that I was in charge. That my reason and my will are the thing that are going to get me to succeed in life. So I kept working at it, and it was still difficult, but I was accepting this idea that I could turn it over. I could maybe turn it over. But I kept running into a lot of problems with it, and one day I was writing on it, and I realized that the thing that was really, I was finding a lot of resistance, was a voice in my head. And I just started to think about what that voice was, and I realized that voice was my oldest friend, that we went to high school together. He was the person who had introduced me to, like, the idea of atheism and everything. And he was still my really, really close friend. I talked to almost every day. And what was stopping me was I was embarrassed at the idea that I would tell him that now I'm going to accept a higher power, you know. I was really scared about it. And I shared that with my sponsor. And I decided through his direction to give him a call. This isn't, like, not about amends or anything. I just wanted to give him a call and tell him. And so this guy who had, you know, who's written books about rejecting faith and religion and all this kind of stuff, I was about to tell him that I'm now in this program where we're going to pray and I'm gonna turn my will over. And I call him and I tell him that that's what's going on with me. That I'm afraid to tell you that I am in this program, that I'm attempting to give into faith and let go of this idea that there is no higher power and that I can turn my will and my life over to it. And I'm just afraid of what you're going to think of me. And he said, and this guy is the most caustic wit you've ever met. He is incredibly sharp. incredibly, like, just, you know, his brain works so fast, I'm just ready for whatever comes. And he says to me, he's like, "My friend, I love you." And that's it. That's all he said. And it gave me permission. And I took it. And that was the second big thing that happened in my recovery, where I started to really surrender enough, where I can really connect the dots and say, I am eating like this because I am terrified of life and of what others are going to think of me and the outcome of things. And the idea of turning my will over to a higher power is about acknowledging and accepting the things over which I have no control and then letting them be handled by something else, something greater than me. Because the other way just isn't working. Most of my life, I have spent in one way or another in what I call the bunker of my head. I go into my deep into my head in my worst times. I go into the bunker of my head and I shut the doors and the windows and the portcullis and the chain everything up. And in there, I can indulge myself in the fantasy that I have control. That I can manage what's going to happen in the future. I can think about it and worry about it. You know, OA has 9 tools. If you go to the website, you'll see that there are 9 tools that you can use for recovery. And if you look at them, you'll see that worrying is not one of them. Because it doesn't work at all. But as a kid, I think because I was so scared, I think I started to feel like worrying was an action. You know, like if I worry about this enough, maybe it'll be different, you know. Or maybe sometime I worried about something and it worked out. And then I thought, oh, see, it's because I worried about it. You know? So when I'm in the bunker, I'm either in the future, which is about anxiety and fear, or I'm in the past, which is about shame and regret. When I'm in the bunker, I'm really sometimes just really rolling over those things in the past, you know. I'm refighting all those fights. This time I say all the right stuff. You know, they all, you know, tremble at my tremendous comebacks, you know. The one place I'm not when I'm in the bunker is in the present, which is, ironically, the only place I can actually experience my life. I can't control what has happened in the past. It's really hard. It was really hard for me to accept that. And I can't control what's going to happen in the future. I do not know what's going to happen. I don't have control over it. And that's really still to this day very hard to accept. That I can't control. But one day at a time, I turn over, thank you, 10 minutes, I turn over this fear and this anxiety. I brought up the big book because I was thinking of my sponsor, and he kept talking, we always talked about this chapter in the big book, Acceptance is the Answer. I'm sure you all know it. And I committed this paragraph to memory. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. You know, when I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can have no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be. Now, I've been saying that by rote forever, like memorized it, and I thought I should look this up. To see if I actually memorized it right, you know? And I did. However, this is the book that I did this, and I was talking before about how I had a real hard time accepting a higher power. I looked and I highlighted this paragraph, but I defiantly did not highlight the line, "Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake." I didn't highlight that line. Why? Because at that time, I was saying in my head that I didn't like the idea of, like, God's world. Nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Like, God has a plan, you know. I was really, like, rejecting that idea. And that's because that's the idea I was imposing on it. That's what I was telling myself that meant. Now I'm in program for a while, and it means something else to me now. When it says nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake, to me is that there are no mistakes. In order for there to be a mistake, there would have to be the way things are supposed to be. Like, there would have to be a correct and supposed way of things to turn out in order for any of that to be a mistake. And me deciding something is not supposed to be that way, that's just me. That's just vanity. That's just control. That's just me thinking that, you know? My father died at the very early age of 62. And my sister died at the perversely young age of 28. These are two events that were incredibly difficult for me and incredibly sad, but they weren't mistakes. They were things that happened. And I can either accept those things, or I can pretend that somehow I can avoid the feeling, that I can somehow change the outcome, that I can spend a lot of time pretending and praying and fantasizing about it. And I can't. I wish it was different, you know. I would love for it to be different. But acceptance has to do with accepting the way things actually are. And that's what I have never been to be able to do my whole life, and that's what has always driven me to the food, this fear. So now I have a power greater than myself. I couldn't accept the power, in my case, I couldn't accept the power that's very much like a religious power or a Judeo-Christian, you know, image, you know, magic grandpa in the sky. I can't think of that, and that doesn't work for me. So I took a lot of solace from the big book where we learned that I can choose my own conception. So for me, my higher power is a river. It's not a river that I'm standing on the bank of. It's a river that I'm in. I'm in the river. It's flowing through me. It's flowing through all of this and all of us. It's going in a direction. This river doesn't really know me. This river doesn't have my back. This river doesn't really care about how things turn out for me. You know, the river just is. When I am able, when I'm spiritually fit enough to be able to let go and let the river take me where it needs to take me, where it just is going, my life is better. And when I fight it, when I swim against the stream, when I just don't want to accept where this river is going, I just end up frustrated and exhausted and depressed and still at the same place. The river is taking me over here anyway. So am I going to go reluctantly or am I going to go willingly? Am I going to accept that this is where we're going? And by the way, how do I know what that is going to turn out to be, where this river is taking me? I've just decided some story about what the future is going to be. I'm sure everybody in this room can list 1,000 examples in your life where you thought this was going to be the outcome of something and then it turned out to be something else, you know, good or bad. So, I just wanted to, as I thought about coming to this meeting, I just really thought about fear a lot. And I'm sure you're all regulars at this meeting, probably you know that the meeting is named after that famous saying, it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. And I have spent a lot of years cursing the darkness, and it did nothing. I have resisted the concept of a power greater than myself taking care of things, of handling things that I'm worried about. I prefer now to light a candle. I prefer to be in fellowship. You know, I prefer to come to a room with a bunch of people and share with you the very things that I don't want anybody to know about me. You know. And, you know, your heads go like this instead of like, you know. And so I just, I'm really grateful today. I'm grateful that this obsession over like sugar and flour particularly has been lifted. I'm grateful that I don't use food today. I eat food. I still sometimes eat too much food. I still deal with like this. What I told you is like I'm going to have breakfast at noon, and then I'll have lunch at 6 p.m. and then dinner at 1:30 a.m. and then I'm never going to run into troubles. You know, I'm still trying messing around with that. I just less than a month ago, maybe about a month ago, I finally accepted that I couldn't that I was powerless over corn chips. I had let go of chips. And then I thought, no, but I could eat corn chips because they're not flour. They're made of corn. You know what I'm saying? And they just kept beating me up and beating me up and beating me up. And I finally accepted it and added it to foods that I call, you know, my red light food list. I'm sure you all heard that I have a green light, yellow light, and red light food list. So green light are the foods that I can eat all I want. It's never going to cause any obsession. Red light are the foods that I can't even start eating because once I start, I can't stop. And yellow light foods are the foods that I have yet to admit are red light foods. You know. And so now I'm grateful that I have enough recovery and I have enough willingness and honesty that I can move one of the things off the yellow into the red. I'm super grateful that I've made it to 6 years of abstinence, and I'm super grateful to be here sharing. So thanks for letting me share. Oh, yeah. Is time for questions? Go ahead.
Thanks for your sharing. How do you define your abstinence, and what does a typical day of abstinent eating look like?
Okay, thank you for asking. My abstinence... Yes, the question was, how do I define my abstinence? What is my abstinence, and what's a typical day of eating for me? My abstinence is I eat 3 meals a day with an occasional snack, and that snack is based on work and not like because I want it. The meals have to have a beginning and an end, and then I also have a series of foods that I abstain from completely, including recreational sugar, flour, corn chips, chips of any kind at this point. So that's what it looks like for me. Mike.
Thank you so much. Can you talk about the areas where you feel you're still not, or like areas where you have felt it took you longer to believe that God would resolve those areas, and like how did you deal with that?
Yeah, the question was, what are the areas that it took me longer to turn over to a higher power, and how did I resolve it? When it happens, I'll let you know. But mostly when it comes to personal relationships, I still deal with a lot of fear about what individuals are going to think of me. And in particular, I'm really afraid of the telephone. Like, I'm afraid to make phone calls. Like, I'm afraid to answer the phone. Because I don't know what's going to happen when I make that call. I don't know what's going to happen when I answer the call. You know what I mean? And that's still something that I talk to my sponsor about all the time. And I think this is exactly an example of what I should turn over. Just answer the phone. Just dial the number. And whatever happens on that call, we'll find out what happens. And it'll work itself out in one way or another. That one is really a sticky wicket for me. You know? So, thank you.